The use of civil citations instead of arresting children on the First Coast is being called a big success. But how does it actually work? And is it making lasting change? Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Charlene Shirk in for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9. And make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we're going to hear about this use of civil citations. Is it helping kids, troubled kids, stay on the right track? Is it doing enough? Then later, international medical marijuana companies are now coming to Florida. Why? Who they are? What they're going to do? We're going to talk all about it. Plus, it's a new collaboration between WJCT and Modern Cities. We're going to tell you about the launch of The Jackson. All of that and much more ahead. But first this hour, the Florida Senate has passed a bill requiring law enforcement officers to issue civil citations to qualifying nonviolent juveniles rather than arresting them. Well, the First Coast has a long history with civil citations, or also known as diversion programs, dating back to former state attorney Harry Shorstein. But they are also controversial, detractors claiming that they don't do enough to deter future criminal activity from a youth offender. Most recently, the fallout after the deadly mass shooting from a former student at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. The young suspect, Nicholas Cruz, was given a civil citation and referred to a diversion program after he committed an act of vandalism as an eighth grader. Jacksonville Civil Citation Program is overseen by a juvenile justice advisory committee made up of community stakeholders that meet regularly to review the program along with the efforts really around the whole country. So joining us this morning to walk us through the process, its progress, and its future are Laura Lambert, Juvenile Director of the 4th District State Attorney's Office. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Charlene.
And Kim Sertivan, President and CEO of the Youth Crisis Center, one of the diversion programs that provides services to young people who receive a civil citation. The number to call if you'd like to be part of this conversation is 549-2937. So, Laura, I'd like to start with you a little bit, if that's okay. Let's talk about the program itself, the history, why it was implemented. I mentioned that I've been a reporter in this town for a long time. I remember Harry Shorstein, a big proponent of the program. Then Angela Corey came in, kind of, I like some of these parts of the program. I'm not a big fan of these parts of the program. So it kind of became a little bit controversial. And now with the new administration, we're full on, we're committed, we're actually being looked at as a model for the state.
That's exactly right, Charlene. We're very excited about where our civil citation program currently stands here for the First Coast and, frankly, around the state. In May of 2017, 22 stakeholders in our community, law enforcement, service providers, the court, the state attorney, the public defender, came together because everybody felt like we wanted to see some uniformity in the way that civil citation was being utilized. Law enforcement wanted more tools in their tool belt. And so we had a convening where these people came together and came to agree on what we would permit the civil citations to be issued for here on the First Coast.
So can we go there?
Sure.
Because, I think one of the concerns is that, it's too much of a little slap on the wrist and we're not doing enough. These don't do enough to prevent future offenses. So what qualifies, and I mentioned qualifying youth offender, what qualifies for a civil citation and what does not?
So that's a great question. I do want to be clear that misdemeanor offenses are the only thing that qualify for civil citation. And this is a program that the legislature of Florida has put into our statutes. They have said what is and is not permissible. So with regard to misdemeanors, it's most any misdemeanor save certain traffic offenses and any misdemeanor that would include a weapons crime. So these are what we see in our community are petty thefts, trespassing, resisting without violence, some simple battery. So those are really the things that misdemeanor possession of marijuana. Those are the things that predominantly law enforcement has decided that they want to write civil citation for.
And what age range are we looking at?
So civil citation is 18, under 18.
Okay.
So that is who would qualify for this program. And law enforcement, really, what the state attorney's office did in this MOU was we really took ourselves out of the process. We firmly believe that law enforcement are the best situated on the ground to make the determination for what is the best course of action for these kids. And based on the response that law enforcement has given and the fact that we are riding at such a consistent and high way of kids who are eligible for civil citation, I think shows that this was a program that law enforcement was really ready for and excited for.
And Kim, I'd like to bring you in the conversation. At Youth Crisis Center, you've been around 40 plus years, one of the first runaway shelters, kind of that's how you became known in the community, but you, the organization has evolved over the years based on the needs of the community. We're talking about these kind of misdemeanor things and these kinds of petty theft or fighting or shoplifting or things of that nature. Talk a little bit about the services, because you see these kids all the time. You see them from this degree to more serious domestic violence situations. Are these the kinds of things where a child needs to be in a court of law and in do jail time? Or are these the types of misdemeanors and activities that therapy and intervention can truly help?
So these are the types of behaviors that early intervention that we would look at as prevention of going deeper into the system would really help. So, you know, at first onset, if you're starting to see a child trespassing or a child starting to steal things, those are symptoms, those are warning signs there that there's something happening that you need to get assistance for. And so, you know, with Youth Crisis Center services, both outpatient and with residential short-term services, it's an early intervention to prevent them from going deeper into the system. And so for a child to be criminalized and go into the juvenile detention center is very significant. It's a lot of trauma is exposed to that child of other type of criminal, you know, behaviors and things of the nature. So being able to have them sit down with a therapist and talk about what led that child to commit that act. And our residential program is being piloted right now around the state of offering residential services for kids that are being issued a civil citation for domestic violence. And a lot of these domestic violent issues are occurring over cell phones or food or very petty things that end up having an argument with their family that gets out of control. And so really trying to bring the child in, talk with them about opportunities for coping skills, but also bring the family in to talk about this. It's a family issue that's occurring when it happens with domestic violence. And so we're able to then prevent that child from going deeper into the system. So it's an early intervention opportunity.
Yeah, you know, there's nothing worse than seeing a child in a Department of Corrections jumpsuit and handcuffed. You know, I've covered it for years, and there's just nothing more heartbreaking than to see that. And Kim, I want to go back to it real quickly. When you said some of the domestic violence issues, I think when we think domestic violence, we think, you know, father, mother, you know, an adult in the home. But there are times where the child becomes the perpetrator as part of their acting out. And you mentioned cell phones and food. What do you mean by that?
So if you have a child that is wanting something and their parent is trying to take something from them, that child's needs are not being met. It's kind of a temper tantrum, if you will, mm-hmm. but it gets a little out of control. And so we have kids that are, you know, wanting to go to the fridge and take something out to eat, and the parent's saying, no, we're not able to have this meal at this time or this thing. And it could be because there is low income issues in mm-hmm. the home. And so they're getting into arguments over this, or, you know, cell phones, wanting to have their phone, and the parents are asking them to get off their phone, or gaming systems. So it's just your typical sort of youth and teenage issues that are occurring that gets out of control. It starts with yelling, and then that yell hits, you know, gets into a fight, and then that fight gets out of control. And then the child, you know, the parent calls the officer, the child then could be arrested or could be issued a civil citation. And so when you really hear the stories that our therapists hear, it's things that could be prevented. And so we're offering an opportunity to share that with the family of, here are some coping skills so it doesn't get out of control the next time.
Because sometimes the family becomes traumatized that the child is the behavioral issue. There's something wrong with the child. And then there may be other siblings in the home. And that creates, you mentioned, a very traumatic environment. So it's good to get the whole family involved. Laura, let me ask you this. When a child receives a civil citation, walk us through the process. Okay, what happens now? Am I a parent and I get that call that the child's been taken to the police department? Do I get something in the mail? How does it work? And then how does an organization like YCC, and there are others also involved in the civil citation program, to intervene and provide services? Can you walk us through it?
Absolutely. So one of the things that civil citation really does well is it provides swift accountability and swift consequences for our youth. And so when a youth receives a civil citation, the officer on the ground writes them kind of like a ticket. It's a uniform civil citation that we have here in the Fourth Circuit. And that ticket goes to teen court. Teen Court is run by the clerk of court here in Duval County. Clay County and Nassau County also have teen courts. And there is a teen court administrator who runs the program and is really the one who's on the ground engaging with these kids. They have case managers. They provide the services. So once the ticket is received, I think an important thing to note is the youth has to admit guilt, which I think is an important part of this process. It's providing immediate accountability of what they did. Then teen court reaches out to the family and brings them in within 3 days. So usually this is, it's a very quick process. I think we all, those of us who have children know the longer you wait from the time of the behavior, the less effective the punishment can be. And so here you're getting immediate repercussions for actions, but also addressing, you know, like Kim was highlighting, what are other services? What are the underlying needs that these children have? What is causing this behavior? And I think the research is great in this, and people who may believe that this isn't stringent enough, I think what I would say to them is the research shows that our recidivism rate, which means kids who in the next year to 2 years pick up a new charge, is at about 4%. So of the youth who go through the civil citation program, receive services, and complete that program, we're only seeing about 4% of them coming back in the system, which is a really great thing because what it shows is we're addressing through services these underlying issues that could be causing the criminal behavior.
And you obviously need community support for these programs to work. We've got Sam on the line from the Beaches. Sam, you want to share a story about you're part of this a neighborhood accountability program?
Yes, I am. I am a part of the Neighborhood Accountability Review Board, along with former Mayor Harriet Pruitt and some concerned citizens. And we get together and we moderate these programs. And what we found is that a lot of these children under the age of 18 are really good students, but then they make teenage silly mistakes. But we do not want their future to be marred by a criminal record. And what we found is that it really has been working. And when they come back for the final review, they really show some remorse. And we don't have that recidivism within the system. And my concern is to keep them in the classroom because we want them to be educated. That's the primary reason I'm running for the school board, is because we're concerned about the education of these students. And I think with this system, it has been working and it's good for the students. My concern is, are we going to expand the program? That would be my question.
All right. Thank you. Great question. And Sam, good luck on that school board election. We appreciate you being a part of the community. So let's talk about that. How do we grow that program? All eyes are on us right now. And a bill just passed for the state of Florida to provide civil citation opportunities to law enforcement across the state.
So I think we're doing a great job in enacting this program. I know I cannot compliment law enforcement enough on being engaged on the ground. I mean, Sheriff Williams has regular meetings with his staff to say, are there missed opportunities, places where youth should have received a civil citation and they didn't? So I think addressing ongoing training will only increase our civil citation numbers. As for expanding the program, one of the things that is very important to Melissa Nelson and her administration is looking at diversion practices as a whole. So civil citation is one type of a diversion practice, but we also have diversion programming for children who've been arrested, for kids who have been through the system. And so one of the things that the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, which you mentioned earlier, is doing, it's a group of 23 members of the community who have attended a year-long programming that our office has brought speakers. We've brought lots of different innovative ideas to this committee to say, how are our diversion practices going as a whole? Is what we're doing right now working well? Are there areas we could be more innovative, do things better? And that committee is in the process right now of having their meetings, and they will eventually, hopefully this fall, present a report to the state attorney's office on just what you brought up. What are ways that we can increase diversion? What are ways that we can improve diversion and hopefully even get to kids or charges that are not appropriate for civil citation, but would be appropriate for other diversion.
And Kim, as being a partner with this program and really administering some of the intervention and the counseling, how do you contribute to those questions? What's working, what's not working? And Sam brought up a question. I think that was a big issue. Like, kids are getting detention or they're getting expelled and great, now they're sitting at home or they're running the streets. They're not being educated. They're not interacting with their other their peers, and they're not getting counseling. So these poor kids really have nowhere to go with this. So Kim, are you able to provide services to keep them within the education system? And what feedback are you able to provide to say, hey, what's working, what's not, and where do we have to grow our intervention opportunities?
So we have continued to partner with Teen Court, and that, my understanding, is going very well, where we're partnering, we're communicating, we're providing referral sources and collaboration on what we have learned from the situation, whether it's the child or and or the family, of what we feel, too, is best for that family once we have done therapy. And so being able to sit down with Teen Court and collaborate on referral opportunities, whether it's to YCC or to another partner in the community, I think is huge, and really treating the family as a whole, because when a child is in trouble, it does affect the family, whether they think that is the case or not. Being able to now measure what is going to lead a child to further perpetrate, YCC is getting ready to pilot the rollout of a tool that's called the Adolescent Domestic Battery Typology Tool. And that is in the state where we'll be able to look at treatment options for this individual while they're in our program, and then also, again, offer opportunities for referrals based on the typology tool, that is to say whether or not this child will perpetrate in the future for domestic violence in particular. So I think that there's a lot of successes. In terms of education, while the child is with us in residential, we do partner with Duval County Public Schools, and we have four educators on our campus that are providing academic instruction while the child is with us. So they are not missing class. They get grades. If they're testing for FSAs, we do testing for FSA. And as far as the outpatient sector, if the child is being referred to us for non-residential services, we will make sure that that child is in school. We want to make sure that that child is receiving the opportunity to be educated and have testing and so forth. And so we partner with the school system in that regard.
It seems like we're getting a lot of positive feedback from the community. And Kim, that's fascinating in terms of having predictors to be able to see future behaviors. I think that's the big question, is that's great, we're intervening now, but what impact are we making in this child and the community's future? We've got Bob on the line from Atlantic Beach. Bob, thanks so much for calling in.
Good morning. I work with a nonprofit called First Coast Maritime. We've partnered with Jacksonville organization Mad Dads, and we're taking a lot of the young folks, or some of the young folks, who go through intervention programs and training them to become merchant seamen. In the 6 years we've been doing this, we have about a 75% employment rate. We've got about 125 people employed today, and they're bringing in $6.25 million to the Jacksonville economy every year through employment. Diversion programs are really a good idea, and I don't know how I can express my joy that we're looking to expand these programs and make them better. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Bob. The ladies here are just lighting up in this room right now.
Well, but I want to go ahead, Charlene. I just wanted to make one quick point to kind of piggyback on our last caller. So, approximately 700 youth in this last year has been served circuit-wide by civil citation. And there's a 2011 study that shows that, there's a huge taxpayer savings of sending these kids through diversion. It costs approximately between $1,500 and $4,500 per kid for them to engage in the juvenile justice system. So if you think about the cost savings that are happening with those kids not being arrested, the officer time off the street, those officers get to write a ticket, and then they're right back out there, looking for, crime and violent activity. I think it really cannot be understated how great it is for the community to save money, to help produce productive members of the community who will go back out and engage and become taxpayers themselves.
I mean, because to have something on a record, we've just did the Ban the Box. We've talked about how it's hard for people to find employment if they've got these things on their records. I do want to go, I do want to talk about the Parkland, the shooting situation, because I think that the people who are opposed to this program, this became all the talk of the town when it was discovered or shared that Nicholas Cruz, the suspect, he had apparently committed some vandalism in eighth grade. He had been given a civil citation. He had been directed to a program called the Promise Program. So a lot of folks were talking about saying, well, if he had been arrested at that time, then he wouldn't have been able to get a gun and we could have prevented this mass shooting. So I think all the folks that really do want to wrap their arms around diversion programs, I think this is their deep, dark fear that if we don't intervene in a much harsher way at some point, that this could be something that occurs. Kim, you have really been following this story and the development because of the mental health component. And at YCC, you offer mental health services in addition to other services. Can you give us a little bit of, walk us through what happened in this situation, if you will, and why this really, this diversion, the civil citation, really didn't apply to the needs of this young man to begin with?
This young man suffered tremendous trauma and mental health issues at a very early age. And I think that there were so many things that were broken and there were so many gaps in his care that the system really did not help this child and this young man, where once he lost his mom, you know, he never continued his services. He never completed the civil citation program. And so when you are not tracking this child from early ages and it indicated that he had some behavioral outbursts in preschool, those are things that you need to start monitoring and paying attention to and ensuring that he continues in the services. So this young man had some deep, dark issues that occurred very early that continued to exacerbate as he grew older. And so giving him at that time the civil citation was warranted because of the behavior that happened. So the linkage of him having some vandalism was the appropriate measure in terms of the civil citation. But looking at him as a whole, it was not, in terms of being able to say that this child was growing up with the proper services so that potentially that would not have occurred. So the linkage of him being able to purchase a weapon did not match what was given into the civil citation because of what he was arrested for, or not arrested for, rather. So,
and he had been, apparently officers have been called to his home over domestic violence issues.
Right.
About 20 times they were saying. So for YCC, in fact, you offer that, the residential services. So if in this particular case, in a perfect world, a much better solution would have been someone had picked him up from his home and brought him to an organization like YCC to get him out of the home.
Absolutely. And that there we could have looked into the history and started looking into proper services and engaging in other means to collaborate with the community to help this individual and wrap our arms around and follow the child. Because there were some gaps with that. No one was following, no one was tracking, and no one made sure he did not complete the program. So that's an indicator there. If you're not completing the civil citation program, then there needs to be a deeper look into what would have helped, why did you not, and what's the next step.
Yeah, because the findings of the commission were that the diversion program had no role in this and could not have prevented what he did. Let's talk about, though, the importance of, Kim just brought up a really good point about having to have the conversation, having to be connected, looking at the child as a whole. Because if you just look at, okay, he vandalized a sink in eighth grade, it doesn't tell you a whole lot about the complexity of what this young man was going through. So how are you all communicating with each other? How are you in this this group of folks who the commission that's coming together? How are they creating a communication opportunity to look at a child as a whole and improve the program and not let these kids fall through the gaps?
I mean, that's a great question. I think a continuum of care for our kids is so important. And so, for example, a kid who comes through a civil citation program, if the director of teen court, Stacey Peterson, feels like that kid is not engaged, that kid has deeper seated issues, she'll pick up the phone and call me and say, hey, I think this kid may be better suited for your office if they have not completed the program, things like that. Additionally, I think it's really important for us to have ongoing conversation with the schools. I know in Duval County, we're looking at increasing our full service plus school models. So essentially that's having a social worker, mental health people on site at the school. I think that communication is a huge barrier, or has been historically, in the way a lot of our organizations have operated. And so sharing the results of assessment, sharing the results of different behavioral issues that are seen in the school so that we can get a fuller picture is very important. And right now we have really good relationships with the school. One of the members, a person who works for Duval County, is on our advisory committee. So we have good communication and conversations about kids that are engaged there. But I also think we can do better. And I know that's something that the Kids Hope Alliance is really involved in, is the intervention and prevention side of things, really identifying these kids at an early age and making sure we are loading them up with what it is that they need at that time so we can prevent a situation like we saw in Parkland.
And with YCC, we lowered our age that we're serving children now to 3. Because we really found that, you know, as you're starting to enter into preschool years, you're starting to see some behaviors that parents are just like, you know, is this typical preschool activity? Is there something that has happened biologically, genetics? You know, how can I help? And so, no, you're not bringing a 3-year-old in to do therapy. You're bringing a 3-year-old in to have that conversation with the parents and start building the relationship there and the mental health component to determine what path and what track you can try to help that family. And talking about targeted case management and where you have sort of a brokerage system where one individual is following the family to link that family, link that individual with other community partners. And so for us, we provide discharge plans. We have case summaries. We're following up with state attorney's office if we have a family to say whether or not that child is compliant or not, so that we can look at whether or not the case should be closed, whether more intensive services should be offered, and really making sure that the community is relevant. If more intensive services are needed, how do we build that? And I think we've done a great job of coming together to create focus groups to determine what level services does our community need.
And Kim, there's no shame in calling and asking for help. So often when we hear about these people who do these acts, you just track it down to even as a small child, they exhibited this behavior, as a young adult or as a teen. And there was, in the heartbreak, I think, is there were so many opportunities to intervene and to prevent. So can you just speak to the families out there and let them know that there's no shame in giving a call, and the services are confidential and they're private, and they really do empower the entire family to be able to act as a whole so that we don't have these situations and end up having to be reactive.
Right. And I think, you know, there are lots of organizations in the community, YCC being one, that has a 24-hour hotline where you can call and speak to a live person about your circumstances, or you can look at the website, you can email us. And just having, you know, is this typical or not? And just the way I look at it, you're just putting tools in your toolbox to be able to say, if this circumstance happened at my child's age of 9, I want to make sure that when they're 18, 25, 30, that they're going through things that they can go back and say, okay, this is how I should deal with this. And so you're developing that individual just as you would develop them academically or any other way with medical services. Mental health is not shameful. It's something that is real. It's something that you can try to prevent from further deepening into any kind of a system.
And doesn't mean you're a bad parent.
Not at all. Not at all. And it means that you just are reaching out to ask questions and to say, hey, let me run this by you. And what do you think? I mean, it's very real. And not talking about it, not reaching out, you leave a big question mark of what that individual is going to look like. So if you realize that a child is sick, you're going to get them help. If you realize your child has academic problems, you may get them a tutor. If you realize your child is starting to act out or is starting to have some sounds, you know, signs of being sad or anxious, you're reaching out for help. It's no different.
And Kim, can you give the website to the Youth Crisis Center so folks can learn more about your services?
It's ycc.org.
Okay. And Laura, is there a website that folks can go to learn more? And maybe if they want to serve on this commission or be a part of the community that they can go to?
Yes, there is. We do have I think it's sao4th.com.
And so I'm putting her on the spot.
I know. I'm kind of like looking at my phone trying to find
our website. Well, if you just Google sao.org or annual report, it's really interesting. You can read all about it. Ladies, thank you so much. Laura Lambert, Juvenile Director, 4th District State Attorney's Office. Kim Sertivan, President, CEO of Youth Crisis Center. Thank you so much for being a part of the solution.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Up next, an Israeli medical marijuana company is coming to Florida. Well, we're going to talk about that. Stay tuned. Things are about to get interesting. Back in a moment, everybody. Welcome back, everyone. While the use of medical marijuana is something new to Florida, it's been around for years in other places of the world. Tikkun Olam, which is Hebrew, roughly means to heal the world or repair the world, began operations in Israel back in 2005, distributing medical cannabis for free to patients in need. The company is now one of the world's best known dispensaries of medical marijuana, and they are coming to Florida. Joining us now on the line is Tikkun Olam COO Jeffrey Jones. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
So tell us a little bit more about the company and how it came about.
Sure. Tikkun Olam, as you said, has been around for a little over 10 years. We're out of Israel, and Israel has established itself over that time as the clear leader of medical cannabis around the world, the epicenter of the medical cannabis movement. And from that experience, Tikkun Olam arose and became the market leader there. We forged the market in Israel. And Tikkun was born of a social movement. And I think you alluded to it in your introduction, where medical cannabis was not legal in Israel. And our founder is a guy named Tzachi Cohen. He is Israel is a nation of soldiers, and he's returning from a deployment and discovered that marijuana relieved his symptoms. It was illegal at the time, and he organized a social movement to lobby the authorities in Israel to legalize medical cannabis. And that was about, gosh, like I said, 10 years ago. And we're expanding around the world now and are happy to be in the United States and particularly happy to be coming to Florida soon.
And why do you think it took off so well in Israel? When you say he came back and he brought this, where you've had a lot of pushback in other states and other countries, why did Israel really launch this, and why is it known for this?
There's a couple of things. One, I think the social movement itself, the organization that Tikkun Olam led to advance this in Israel, was part of it. But there was also a doctor in Israel by the name of Rafael Mashulam, and he was the first person to really look at cannabis as medicine and to study it. He was the first person to recognize and separate the different cannabinoids, THC, CBD, etc. And that was part of it. It was rooted in science, and it was rooted in medicine, and it was born out of that social movement.
And so you're coming to Florida. Talk about the movement to go from you know, country far away to now here, right here in Florida. And as you know, I'm sure you're familiar with, we've had a tug of war with the legalities of exactly how it would be dispensed and administered.
Sure. Well, we have a great partner there in Florida. We work with partners in all of these different states. They, in fact, grow the cannabis, and they, in fact, make the medicine to our specifications. And our partner there in Florida is called VitaCann. And we were particularly attracted to them because they are so aligned with us in terms of their commitment to cannabis as medicine. They have a 7,000-square-foot GMP facility to make our medicines to a pharmaceutical standard. And we will be bringing that medicine beginning probably in November. VitaCann is open now. They are dispensing other forms of medical cannabis, and our products will be on the shelf there by the end of the year.
Do you find that part of having relationship with some of these dispensaries in the United States and particularly in Florida, do you find much of it's a learning curve and process? Since 2005, you all have been implementing this, and some of your research was even from earlier than that. Do you find that part of what you're doing is not just, you know, opening, if you will, a new franchise, but it's actually an education process?
Absolutely. That always comes first. And that's one of the things that I think differentiates Tikkun, but more importantly, I think makes us a player that can balance the discussion on cannabis. I think America is still confused about cannabis, and we've been able to come forward with science and with medicine. We've done true clinical trials in Israel, double-blind, placebo-based, peer-reviewed type of trials. We've been able to use those to educate people here in the United States. We have 12 years of what I would call observational data in Israel, where our cannabis strains have been prescribed by a doctor or a nurse for a specific medical condition or a symptom of that medical condition. And then the doctor or the clinician has followed up with that patient over the course of time to record and understand how these different strains of cannabis are working to improve that symptom. So, yeah, education is a huge part of it. And every new market that we enter, we look to engage the medical community first, and share this data with them, share our experience, share those clinical trials, share those observational studies that we have done.
And something that you said stood out to me when you said that Israel is a country of soldiers, and we have a large military community here on the First Coast. And as we know, that many of our military, unfortunately, are coming back with physical injuries, chronic pain, as well as PTSD issues. Can you speak specifically to how some of the medical marijuana is treating, as you mentioned, our country of soldiers, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely. It's worked very well in Israel, and people are beginning to understand how well it works here, both for PTSD, as you mentioned, and chronic pain. So we look to engage in Florida, as we have in other states, not just the medical community, but work with local veterans organizations as well, and trying to get over the stigma that still lingers. You know, it's part of balancing the discussion, as I mentioned earlier. There's still, unfortunately, in some circles, this stigma that lingers around cannabis, and we're trying to educate first and make folks understand and appreciate the medicinal value of our strains and cannabis generally.
And Jeffrey, I think when you're saying the pushback that you receive and the stigma that you receive, I think most folks are concerned about the slippery slope. First, it's medical marijuana. Then people are their legitimate needs, but then people are going to these. I mean, I know when I was a couple years ago, I went to Venice Beach, and outside there was a little pop up shop and a bunch of guys in different colored to look like surgical outfits, if you will, who are just there to write prescriptions. So I think there's that concern that people who really don't need it are going to be utilizing it. And then the recreational part of it, is this a gateway to the recreational marijuana use? I can't help but think that does hinder the efforts in terms of those who legitimately and medically could benefit from it. Would you agree or disagree on that? And what are your insights?
No, I would absolutely agree. And again, it goes back to education and making people understand. And Tikkun Olam partnering with VitaCann in Florida, we're committed to the medical side of cannabis, and we're educating their team. We're educating their patient providers that will be working in the dispensaries to respond in an informed way about what strain may work for a specific condition. But it has to be done responsibly, and we certainly support that. Listen, there's still a lot we don't know about cannabis. We're studying and we're learning every day. And all that information that we've learned in Israel, we're sharing, but we're doing it in a responsible way. For instance, I mean, we do know that cannabis for teenagers and adolescents, can be damaging. That's part of our responsible approach, and that's part of the education initiatives that we're launching in Florida.
Well, Jeffrey Jones, COO of Tikkun Olam, thank you so much for joining us today, giving us an update on the progress and as well as the educational opportunities that are out there. We appreciate it, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Is your American Graduate Champion. WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American Graduate Champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is September 1st, 2018. Go to WJCT.org to nominate your American Graduate Champion today.
You know, Walter, I like you. But you know, man, if somebody offered me $2,200 to kill you, you'd be dead. And you know, I laughed. Not like you're laughing. I went...
Join us for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org, Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back, everybody. It is an industry that has exploded over the past couple of years in Jacksonville. Microbreweries all across the region. Entrepreneurs have been going into beer-making businesses, including specialty brews from the People's Pale Ale to Miles Jack Wasn't Down. I think that's part of the fun. It's just the names of these. Well, the latest edition of Void Magazine takes a look at the microbrew industry in Jacksonville, including some Void Magazine-inspired beers. Ta-da! We are now joined by Void Magazine Editor-in-Chief Matt Shaw. Thanks for coming on this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Man, I thought you were going to bring some samples. What's up with that?
I know. I was planning on being the Hoda Kotb to your Kathy Lee.
Would you have some breakfast brews?
Yeah, apparently there's some FCC or some federal regulations against us drinking on air.
Those always get in the way, don't they?
How did Kathy Lee and Hoda get away with it?
Well, there's always the big question. Is it real? Is it not? Yeah. Is it real? Is it not? All right. So I got to ask, the microbrewery, how and why have we seen this just absolute explosion over this?
I'm not sure, but I think I can't put my finger on it exactly, but when you do go around the country to other growing cities, Jacksonville's not alone in, you know, this explosion of craft beer. It's sort of happening everywhere. And I think there is like a connectivity to it, sort of like a social aspect where it kind of takes on the identity of whatever city they're popping up in. And like you said, the local breweries here have things that are named for local events or things that are happening and sort of tying it to the community. And I think it's just fun for people. And that's sort of this issue kind of focuses on that idea of spirit, being a homonym for both distilled liquor and also, people's persona or their character. And so we try to focus on how that character comes out and how people are inspired by, you know, the act of drinking, which in and of itself is somewhat pointless.
And I do love that the community is engaged in something. And even we have one that just opened up at the beach and, you know, you can bring your dogs. And if you're a local, you get your name on the cup.
Yeah.
And I like that relationship between it. Like the breweries are really, and there's some that you can play giant Jenga in the back. And to your point, it's really become a place not just to sit and drink, but really to be a community together.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think just with, you know, the rise of social media and the way that we sort of interact with each other digitally all the time. I think it seems like coffee shops and breweries and some of these things that people are getting really excited about the craft behind it have become places where people actually engage in person, which is novel these days.
And let's talk a little bit about this Void Magazine-inspired beer. Do tell.
Sure. Yeah. So this is the second year that we've done a collaboration with local breweries. Last year, I believe there was 5, and this year we upped it to 7. And so we, in partnerships with 7 local breweries, we asked them to create a beer inspired by Void Magazine. So inspired by the character of our magazine. And so we got some really interesting submissions this year, really fun stuff. Engine 15 did one that's a pineapple flavored one that we called the Voida Colada.
Yeah. Very cool.
And then, Void has had sort of surfing in its DNA from the very beginning. And so 2 of the beers are actually inspired by a line of surfboards that we're doing this year that are new to our company too. So that's really fun. And each local brewery is doing a release party, which we'll be announcing like through our social media channels. Southern Swells has already done theirs, and there's more to come. So
all right,
stay tuned.
Check out your website for all the dates.
VoidLive.com. Follow us on social media.
All right. Thanks, Matt. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much
everybody.
For having me.
Oh, our pleasure. Anytime. Bring some samples next time. We'll be right back.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
ViStar Credit Union, focused on delivering various loan options to its members while remaining financially strong since 1952. ViStar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
Judge Brett Kavanaugh has built a career doing conservative legal work in Washington. Now he's President Trump's Supreme Court nominee.
A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law.
Already activists are warning that he could overturn abortion rights.
Protect Roe now! Protect Roe now!
I'm Ari Shapiro. The confirmation fight ahead this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Alan Dershowitz is frequently on TV and often near the Trump White House. He's not the only legal scholar questioning the Russia investigation, but few are better known or more controversial. Now, this lifelong Democrat has broken ranks with many liberals to defend President Trump against calls for his impeachment. Alan Dershowitz explains why, next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Everybody is using emojis these days, so much so that they've become their own language, really.
The fact is that the emoji keyboard is the most installed keyboard in the world.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Millions of people use them. Who makes money off them, though? We'll have that story for you the rest of the day's business news and, of course, the numbers from Wall Street next time on Marketplace. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
All right, everybody. Finally this hour, a Jackson is a traditional term for someone from Jacksonville, and it's also the name of a new multimedia partnership between WJCT and Modern Cities. Joining us now to talk about this week's launch of the Jackson, our WJCT news director, Jessica Palumbo, and Mike Field with Modern Cities and all things Jacksonville. Mike, you truly are.
Thank you.
So let's talk about this. Who is Modern Cities? What's going on with this?
Well, so we created Modern Cities as kind of an online space to discuss urbanism, planning, and culture in cities across North America. And because we're all from Jacksonville, we have a particular interest in our city, and we're very passionate about who we are. So we decided that we wanted to create a space just for these issues specific to Jacksonville. And that's where we kind of came on with WJCT for partnership.
And when you say issues specific to Jacksonville, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, so we have kind of a background in urban planning and real estate development, historical research and the like. And so we have kind of a grassroots view of the nuts and bolts in our city. And so we wanted to kind of explore a space where we can take our readers into kind of uncovering the what, where, and why of things that kind of shape our city. And so, you know, WJCT has always been kind of the voice of the community, and we feel this project kind of enhances WJCT's reach by taking a deeper dive into, you know, what makes our city tick.
And Jessica, let's talk about the strategic partnership with this, because you truly are the voice of the community.
We are so excited about this partnership with Modern Cities. We've already been working with Modern Cities for about a year now. We've had Modern Cities on a weekly radio segment that I've been hosting, and this just takes it to the next level. So we still have radio segments that are going to be airing every Thursday during Morning Edition, a couple of times, probably 6:45 and 8:45-ish. You'll be able to hear the Jackson on WJCT. We also have the JacksonMag.com. That is the Jackson website, where you can see all of that analysis and that reporting that you've come to love from Modern Cities. We're also planning live events. We're hoping to have the first one this fall here at WJCT, maybe some sort of panel discussion related to the planning of Jacksonville and the future of the city. Modern Cities does a really good job of looking at the past of the city, the present, and thinking about how to shape the future, which is really cool. And for us, this partnership made sense because as the NPR station in Jacksonville, we don't have sort of the maybe youngest, hippest audience.
Hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You just take a step back on that one, Missy.
I know that might surprise some people.
I'm really excited. I'm called young and hip. So, you know, that's great.
Modern Cities, though, does have that audience already. So we were like, hey, come on, be part of WJCT even more, because this is a group that we really want to
talk to. Exposing what you do on a daily basis to, let's just say, a younger, or maybe the young professionals and new professionals. The economy is growing in Jacksonville, which means more young people are coming, they're getting jobs here, they're starting to be interested in the community. And Mike, it is so important to learn the history of Jacksonville. I know when I knew a little bit about it, as you know, and obviously as a reporter you get the opportunity to learn so much, and then going through Leadership Jacksonville, you know, really seeing pictures and learning. And Jacksonville just always seemed to be the city that, okay, we're on our way. Oh, and then we had a fire. And now we're back. And oh, now we had what, yellow fever. And then, oh, now we're on our way to tourism. And then the railroad went to St. Augustine to the Flagler Hotels instead of Jacksonville. So to me, the history of Jacksonville has really been a story of stops and starts and stops and starts. So what can the site tell us now about how really where we are going in the future, not just our past, but how can we learn from that and really continue to grow and be the kind of city that people want to come to?
Well, I think that's a good question, because people always say, you know, why is Jacksonville like this? So we want to kind of explore, you know, the underlying themes behind why things are. And to understand why things are, you then have an understanding of how you can move it forward. And so that's really our big ethos is, you know, how do we engage just everyday people and to not be so intimidated to say, this is what Jacksonville is. This is why things work this way it is. And this is what we can do ourselves to kind of move it forward. And what we want to do with some of the events we're holding with WJCT is kind of, you know, be a practical guide. So we're going to help hold some forums here at the site that, you know, kind of engage just everyday community people with leaders in their field to show them this is what, you know, this is how you take steps to do things. We're kind of the poster child for what they call tactical urbanism. And that's kind of
I like that term.
It's kind of a term that's based around temporary interventions that any people can do to really make a neighborhood better. And so what we want to do is focus on how can the everyday average Jackson make a difference in their community. That's the practical side. We also want to kind of have some fun with it. There's a lot of people that always say, gosh, I've never knew that existed. And that's pretty incredible because we have a really cool city of really diverse neighborhoods. So one of the events we're looking to do also is what we call neighbor food crawls. And so what we're going to do is kind of take our audience through kind of a culinary journey and that they can share at the dinner table throughout the neighborhood and kind of experience what the neighborhood has to offer with, you know, new and old friends alike. And really just kind of, I mean, who doesn't love, you know, finding new places and finding new places to eat.
And Jessica, before we wrap, this really does put a positive spin on the city. So many times I feel like we have a chip on our shoulder about this community, and it's a great city, and this is going to go a long way to do that.
It's really a place for people to get educated about the city and then get involved. Air segment airs tomorrow morning here on 89.9, and those will all be on our website as well.
Wonderful. Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate everything you're doing for the community, and that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much to all of our guests and our callers. Our producer is the Kevin Mearshart. Michelle Corm runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, masculinity doesn't have to be toxic, does it? They're going to talk all about it. You're going to learn a ton more there. I'm Charlene Shirk, informal Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Till then, make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.